Hello and welcome to Round Peg Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Borhani, geostrategy expert in residence with Business Families Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me today from Singapore is Yulin Yang, the Deputy Group Managing Director of International Marine Corporation, or IMC. Yulin Yang, welcome to Round Peg Podcast. You're the Deputy Group Managing Director of IMC Industrial Group. In my head, IMC stands in terms of acronyms as an impressively massive company. Can you tell us a bit more about IMC's initials, the name, the history, where it all come together?
So originally, it stood for International Maritime Carriers back in the 60s, and they got listed in Hong Kong, I think around 1972, got delisted around 2003. It was started by my mom's older brother, one of my uncles, and the family in 1949, when the communists came to Shanghai, they all left Shanghai. My mom actually had gone direct to New York. And then her older brother, who started the company, came down to Hong Kong, and it was very tough for him because he was 23 years old. His father, my grandfather, was pretty successful businessman in Shanghai, but was not really able to translate all his contacts and all that from Shanghai to Hong Kong. So it was really up to my 23-year-old uncle in 1949-1950 to sort of start things up and support the family. And it eventually became International Maritime Carriers in the 60s. I think they bought their first new build ship in 1966 or 67. Before that, they were using old ships, including when they started old Liberty ships out of World War II. So IMC really is most well-known in the shipping sector, particularly dry bulk, not containers, but dry bulk. And then later on in the 90s, we diversified to chemical tankers. Mm-hmm. When my uncle's son, Chavlet, our chairman and now owner of the shipping side, he came in, he diversified to ports in China, a port in Bangkok, two shipyards, one in Bangkok, one in China, mm-hmm. and it kind of went from there. But from my uncle's time, it was really a traditional dry bulk shipping company.
That's amazing. So could it be said, in a way, you're the pioneers of maritime carriers in Asia Pacific in more ways than one? I mean, not only just moving cargo, but also developing new frontiers, new services, and perhaps being a major stakeholder in development of the GDP of these societies and countries. Is that a fair assessment?
So I think in Hong Kong, my uncle, together with a few other leading ship owners, including the Tung family, including Tung Chee Hwa, who was CEO of Hong Kong, but it was, I guess, Tung Chee Hwa's father, my uncle, YK Pao, there are a few of them who kind of were pioneers to become ship owners. You know, until then, they were, of course, British colonies, and the ship owners tended to be the British ones. So they were, yes, pioneers in terms of being Asian ship owners back mm-hmm. then. Of course, the situation's evolved a lot since then. Now you have a lot of Chinese state-owned as well as private owners. But back in the 60s, 70s, I would say they're pioneers. I think my cousin was a pioneer in terms of, say, Thailand, where he established the first and largest shipyard in Thailand.
Mm. Now, how a gifted Stanford-graduated buzzing lawyer in Silicon Valley is attracted to a massive family business? So what did they tell you to convince you to take you back to Asia Pacific?
And so that's a question I ask myself every, a lot. I ask it less now. Did I make the right decision? I was born and raised in the States. I have 2 degrees from Stanford. I worked at 2 of the top Silicon Valley law firms as an IP lawyer. Then I had 4.5 years as associate general counsel at Acer Computers, where I worked for a very famous, legendary person by the name of Stan Shi, who is considered the father of the IT industry in Taiwan. I think it was a couple of things. I was 33 years old. I was burned out at Acer. Mm-hmm. My uncle had had a stroke for a couple years prior to that, I think in 1990 or 93. So in 94, he started working on me over the course of 8 or 9 months, saying, why don't you give Asia a try, come out and try it out for a while. But, you know, the real truth is when I came out, I met my now wife in Singapore. So that's probably the real reason I stayed in the family business.
How amazing.
But yeah, I do ask myself, did I make the right decision or not?
Well, I guess the tilt to East has been visible to many now, but it started perhaps, I imagine that, you know, this shift to Asia Pacific and to ASEAN has started way back, and now it's the, you know, talk of the day with Belt Road Initiative, etc. So it seems that the stars have aligned in the right way, and that's fascinating. But you're not just contained to, you know, IMC. You have partnerships with companies as big as Chevron, Mitsui, Modec. When you're sitting there as, a globally oriented lawyer, a family business stakeholder, and senior top management, when you look at the dialogue these days, everybody's, you know, well, the best practices should be learned from multinational companies, listed companies, international, you know, behemoths like, you know, some of your partners. Do you think there's tremendous amount of learning to be shared the other way in a reverse osmosis, basically, from family businesses to listed companies of the same ilk? Or it's still on the learning curve from the other side?
Question I ask myself because, you know, I did work in corporate America, and then I would say ACE is an interesting in-between. It felt like family. Stan Shi treated senior people like me like family, but at the same time, we were competing day-to-day with IBM, Compaq, HP, et cetera. So it was a multinational, but family. I think family businesses, a lot of them still need a lot of work on processes, governance. I think it's then in Asia, it still sometimes tends to be like follow the emperor, the top, rather than, you know, sort of responsibilities. You sort of see which way the wind is blowing. In regard for my role dealing with people like Chevron, we actually had a JV that I initiated for 15 years with GATX out of Chicago from 2000 to 2015. Of course, that plays to my strengths. I'm American, I'm from the West. And I talk their talk. Having said that, you know, I have monthly board meetings with Chevron. I see Modec quite frequently. Used to see GATX a lot. It is very different because they're corporate people. They're, you know, dealing with other people's money. When I do things, I think, well, I'm kind of dealing with my cousin's money here, and I know I'm going to have to answer to him. While if you're dealing with these listed companies, it's not the same type of pressure. You know, family businesses are longer term, and I think they can think longer term, especially privately held ones like us. Chevron and GATX, and sometimes they're a little bit worried about their shorter term optics. So I think there is something to be said about being able to be longer term and thinking as if it's your own money, not other people's money.
So when you were with Acer and the legendary Stan Shi, I know that you were at the center of negotiating global commercial contracts for Acer's between 1991 and 1995, which increased, you know, the revenue of the company from close to $1 billion to, you know, a factor of
5.7 billion.
Exactly. So when you look at the dynamics of a family business growing so ambitiously, but hybrid family, I should say. In Acer, you and I agree that it's a hybrid a family spirit, but a listed company. Do you think you could have had the same trajectory, not in terms of your capabilities, but reign and freedom to grow the business the same way had you been with IBM or with another, you know, totally Western American or European listed company?
Definitely not. So I would say at Acer, I got a chance to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. I actually had a job offer from HP, which I was considering at that around the same time. And so, you know, legal departments, I had an offer at Oracle too. I mean, they have huge legal departments. And at Acer, although they had Taiwanese legal department, they realized that as they were doing contracts with Siemens and Compaq and IBM, they needed people whose English was their first language. And for me, I think they felt that also the fact that I can understand Chinese was helpful to communicate with their people. But, you know, there were some issues where the Taiwanese lawyers felt threatened when I came in. I was the second international lawyer. I was based in the U.S., and they would say, hey, you cost the same as four or five Taiwanese lawyers. I go, yeah, but if you put four or five Taiwanese lawyers in the room against IBM or Apple, their English can't be, it's just not fast enough or experienced enough. So, there were some cultural issues too, but I learned a lot. And during that time of fast growth, going from 1 billion to 5.7 billion, Stan gave me a lot of authority, no choice. I was running around the world doing deals. So I learned a lot during that time.
So they took you somewhat back to Asia, but made you run around the world with the same, trajectory and pace. It wasn't just confining you in Asia. Because I think part of the challenge is when you bring global expertise back to their motherlands, back to their geographies or immediate geographies, a lot of them feel contained. And once the two are blended, and the best can come out of them, it's one of the best strategies, you know. So diaspora's concerns coming back is that my pond will be very small again, you know. So I feel that in Acer it wasn't the case for you.
Yeah, I think it was a fit. Had I joined Acer earlier when they were still more local, I wouldn't be able to add value. But I caught it just at the time it was really expanding. It's international business, and so I fit very well. I think similarly with IMC, when I came in, we had just a couple years after I joined, one of my colleagues set up the joint venture with Unical, which then got acquired by Chevron. I initiated the joint venture with GATX out of Chicago. So it was a good fit for my skills. If we were doing more ASEAN-type business, I wouldn't be able to add as much value.
Now, we talked about the hybrids, we talked about the multinational listed companies, and some of your JV partners. But I know that you as well are very much involved on the Asian board of Verl Invest, which are the major shareholders in AbInBev or AbInBev. Mm-hmm. When you compare, Yuelin, the family structure of family businesses as prominent as your own family and IMC. And when you compare that with, European, Scandinavian, Dutch or Benelux families, what are the key differences?
So, Verl Invest is in its 10th or 11th generation. I deal with their family office side, not the AB InBev business. Through FBN, I've interacted with a lot of family businesses. We've actually looking to form joint ventures with some of the Dutch and Belgian family businesses that are active in offshore wind in Taiwan because they have their expertise in the North Sea. I would say the difference is they're typically already older. They've already have more separation between family and business. And I think most striking is the fact that they have external directors, even if they're privately held. And I think Asia still has room, a lot of room to catch up there.
Well, Asia is a very quick learner on all fronts. We both know that. And the rise of China has demonstrated that you come from nowhere and you capture and you become the dominant player. Why is it that you think in some of these best practices, it's still perhaps following, I always remember this a sign on the mirrors. It says the objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. So on GDP and on competition, yes, but why not in corporate governance, in family business law? What is missing in your opinion?
I think they may not, often a lot of the family businesses in Asia, they're often very local in nature, not all, but a lot of them are pretty local. So the Ayalas are very strong in the Philippines. A lot of the family businesses in Hong Kong tend to be real estate based. So, when they're looking at corporate governance, I think they tend to more look like, well, what are best practices in my home market as opposed to global best practices? They don't feel that international pressure. I think companies like Acer or I guess Samsung or places like that, they're facing global competition. And so it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. And so is this a top-down or a bottom-up, or do you think because I think if families can really bring some sort of, this is just my assumption, Yuelin, you're best positioned to answer that. I mean, if you had independent directors and people from creme de la creme of global capacities and capabilities, it would only add to the value of the family businesses in Asia, wouldn't it? I mean, because you can always define the remit of any director, executive or non-executive, but if you unleash their wisdom, God knows what would be the trajectory for some of these Asian companies.
I think that's right. I think another difference in Asia, a lot of the businesses are still first and maybe second generation. So, I've worked with Stan Shih. He's an unusual founder. He's very open to outside opinion. But I think a lot of founders worldwide, not just Asia, are more reluctant to listen to outside opinions. They feel they've been very successful, and therefore they know what's best. So I think that's also a factor in Asia, because they're still younger businesses, so they may not appreciate or be willing to learn to listen to outside opinions as much.
Is there an element of perhaps like any other entrepreneur? Do you as a as a seasoned entrepreneur, lawyer, family business member, do you think there is a bit of perhaps hidden ego, or it's a concern and fear in terms of, why should I do it? I've done it so well. Who knows better than me? Or is mentoring and mentorship something big in Asian families, other than the patriarch, or it's something of a novelty?
So, I think you've kind of touched upon various interesting points. I'm sure it could be different from each person. Some people lack humility. Some people feel insecure. And it's not just Asia. I think there are a lot of family business people who, when you are at a certain level of wealth, you don't want to show that you don't know, or you don't want to admit that you don't know. I think also in Asia, a cultural element will be face. People are very concerned about not losing face. So they may feel it's losing face if they say, well, I need a mentor. Of course, in the U.S., I suspect over a majority of the Fortune 500 CEOs, it's very lonely at the top. It's quite common to have a coach or a mentor. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's so common in Asia.
Now, isn't Asia dealing with two conundrums, in your opinion? One is an aging population in Japan, and even there are talks that China is starting to soon be an aging population. And at the same time, its entrepreneurial body is rather young. So the families, as you rightly said, are still in first, second, max third generation, whereas, in Europe and other, geographies perhaps in a little bit later. But I know that you're a member of Pacific Pension Institute. So
yep.
how these rising social contracts are to be maintained between both government and private sector, and in particular family businesses, which are a great part of the body of the economy there, if the succession plannings and entrepreneurships trajectory is still like, I know it all and I'll do it myself. The cost of a few of these family businesses, God forbid, going belly up could be much more substantial for an aging society with the pace that one would see in Japan, for instance. Isn't that an issue in your opinion? And I know that Japan is different because you have Mitsui's of the world, Mitsubishi's and similar conglomerates, and I know that they're very cash rich, but there is this shift in terms of demographics. So where do you see that in terms of the balance between first, second generation and the social contracts and responsibilities?
So, Pacific Pension Institute is quite interesting. The U.S. pension funds, I think on average, are like 70 or 72% funded. So they haven't, not exactly a good example, but that's because politicians overpromise and never want to cut increased contributions and the returns are not able to match up. I think take China as a very stark example. China, they've been benefiting from the demographic tailwind, but it's clear that they may get old before they get rich. So I think there was a study saying by 2050 that China, the pensions and old age support will cost almost 10% of GDP, while US and UK were at 6.5% or 7%. So you're going to have that high cost for the old people. You're not going to have the young workforce demographic tailwind. And thirdly, old people tend to spend money and not save money. So right now, China's benefited from the capital formation from the very high savings rate, but that won't happen in the future. So China really does need to tap foreign capital, all that. Mm-hmm. At the other end of the bar, Bill, I think what you're coming on to is, say, China. You've got a lot of first and second generation businesses, and some of them are just amazing. You know, we have a potential shipping client, and I go, I've never heard of this company. they wanted nickel for their stainless steel, and they're the world's second largest stainless steel producer, and they only started 15 years ago. So you got these businesses that came out of nowhere. So I think the interesting thing is to figure out, well, but China does have the state-owned enterprise as well. I think Korea would be an interesting example because you got the chaebols that, mm-hmm. I don't know, account for, I think probably Samsung alone is maybe 20% of the stock market capitalization. If you took the top 8 or 10 chaebols, what percentage of the GDP do they constitute? I'm sure it's a very high percentage. So if they can't perform and have succession issues, what is the impact on the employees and therefore their longer-term pensions? I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think certainly in countries like Korea, it could be a huge impact. China, you still have a lot of state-owned enterprises that can provide, I think, a safety net, but they've got an overall macro issue also due to their previous one-child policy as well.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. And that when you talked about that stainless steel company, again, takes me back to the objects in the mirror are closer than they appear.
it's quite incredible. And I remember I met one of my friends was hired as a senior executive for one of the top three real estate companies in China. And, you know, mind you, they're doing $50 billion a year in sales. They do townships of 100,000 people at a time. So I visited their headquarters and I met one of the next generation who's in her 30s. And her dad started the business only like in 1992 and it came out of nowhere. And she asked me a question and she said, look, do you have much experience with Fu or Dai, which means the second generation wealth, like her. and so that I think the second generation wealth in China is going to be different, you know, than elsewhere too.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. And that brings me to, you know, the impact of China's continuous growth. And yes, of course, the growth rates of 8.5, 9 were, you know, nirvana for the world economy, and I still think that 6.5, 7 is still very substantial. What is the view and optics from perhaps where you're sitting with IMC on Belt Road Initiative? Because normally you have been on the bulk maritime shipping services and carrier inbound to China. But China's ambitions are as well expanding to Africa, to, you know, Middle East, to Levant. Do you see that some of your ships are bound to take, I don't know, for many of these infrastructure projects, dry bulk cargo to other destinations for Chinese clients? And what is your view on Belt Road Initiative at large?
So maybe take what we see as opportunities that we're pursuing. So, you know, I think in countries like India, Bangladesh, you know, they're going to need more power, particularly coal. So our ships also carry coal. So we actually are pursuing some projects where we're transshipping coal for them, building basically floating ports. So, I think there'll be opportunities in that regard. I think Singapore has a little bit of concern because maybe Singapore, some of these new ports, and when they get built, will be they'll get bypassed. Mm-hmm. I think that for shipping, we sort of feel it's going to be maybe less long haul ton miles, and it'll be shorter haul trade. But I think that's an overall trend. I think McKinsey did a very good report a few months ago, and they said, hey, global trade is shrinking. Mm-hmm. It's gone down by half from a few years ago. And that's because a lot of it is there's China will produce for the Chinese market. So it's kind of regional supply chains rather than the old model where Asia rose up, where the West outsourced production. You're shipping shoes and, you know, electronic goods back to the Western world. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be less of that. So there's more data and services also being traded rather than just product, which is based on cheap labor. I think on Belt and Road Initiative as a whole, I had the opportunity to moderate a panel on it, so I got a little bit of knowledge from my other panelists. So I think it makes a lot of sense for China. I think there's a lot of criticism in the Western press. Some of it is fair in the sense that, well, you know, can these countries really afford it? Are you putting them into debt traps, et cetera? At the same time, the U.S. did its Marshall Plan after World War II, and that had both economic as well as strategic goals. So I think for China, Belt and Road Initiative, it makes a lot of sense. Who can build ports and railroads the best? The Chinese can. Mm-hmm. They've done it for China. They can do it for the rest. I think geopolitically, for China to swing back to Europe, which is basically the old Silk Road from 1,000 years ago, makes a lot of sense. It's kind of shifting away from the U.S. It also unleashes, opens up China's west.
Correct.
And I think it also opens China up to energy sources, and you know, like gas from one of the stand countries.
Mm-hmm.
Also, from a shipping standpoint, I think they have concerns about a lot of their oil. Most of the oil goes through the Malacca Straits. So now, when you have say gas pipelines across Myanmar, it shortens the sailing distance, and you don't have to go through the Malacca Straits. So I think for China, it makes sense for economic and geopolitical reasons.
Now, I believe that, you know, many times we talk about the growing debt levels by China saddling some of these countries. My view as well is that many of them have been burdened by IMF and World Bank and, you know, restructurings, and have very little to show for it. So there's a good base for leaving something behind and developing some infrastructure. And I think it's in its phase one. So there will be a lot of learning for receiving and countries and as well the Chinese. But I'm sitting today, you're in Singapore today, I reckon, and I'm sitting in London. Mm-hmm. And Europe is going through some of the hottest temperatures, and you know, everything is almost on the verge of sizzling, to say the least.
Same as the American Midwest right now.
Exactly. So I know that International Maritime Organization, IMO, which very much shares the first two initials with your conglomerate, is putting a lot of requests for, you know, emission controls, new emission regulations, catalytic converters for cargo ships and, you know, the vessels. What is your take? What is IMC doing? What are your thoughts there? How shipping companies and industry at large, and perhaps a big player like yourself, play a role, and how real you consider the global warming and climate challenge?
Well, so, you know, shipping, you know, in terms of greenhouse gases, I think contributes a little bit less than 3%. And, you know, given that they, you know, transport 90% of global goods, it's probably not that bad in that sense. At the same time, though, the sulfides and nitrates, shipping is really bad with the heavy fuel oil.
Mm-hmm.
So IMO 2020, when it kicks in January, shipping companies are required to get below, I think, 0.5%. So that means either you put scrubbers on your ships or you switch to low sulfur fuel oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have done is on our ships there, the new build ships that we have on order now, we're putting scrubbers on them.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, though, I think for shipping companies, does it make sense to put a mini refinery on board the ship?
Mm-hmm.
It would be better if the refineries produce more low sulfur fuel oil. But anyway, for some of them, we put scrubbers because you're never quite sure which ports will have low sulfur fuel available. For the older ships, frankly, it's just economically difficult to justify the capital expenditure. So there we'll have to count on getting low sulfur fuel oil. I think, you know, definitely climate change is real. We think about our businesses. We do a lot of coal business out of Indonesia. I guess it's, you know, in a bigger scale, like the oil majors, the Chevrons and the BPs and Totals, when you're doing oil and gas, well, you don't want stranded assets, but you know within, you know, maybe 20 years' time, they may become stranded assets. So I think it's very real. We can see it, you know, as you said, like the hot weather in Europe now or in the Midwest. We have started to go into offshore wind in terms of fabricating some of the transition pieces, the foundations. We think it'll be a big boom in Asia. But yeah, what do you do with your existing core business?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's true for a lot of companies, but also for shipping companies. So ships normally use heavy fuel, which is the residue of fuel. It's really very, very dirty. And then what the scrubber would do is then on board would clean it to clean out the sulfur content.
So Yulin, most of multinationals and listed companies have a budget for research and development. Is there anything like research and development budget in a family business? And if there is, what it consists of and how is it deployed, and just throwing a curveball as a business idea, with having global partners like Mitsui, like MODEC, like Chevron, and the know-how that you have and the visibility, wouldn't it be an opportunity to develop new vessels, new products within these alliances that could address and tackle climate issues, but as well provide a new trajectory and a new, pipeline for your vessels and services in future?
So, you know, on the first question about the R&D and all that, there was, I think, some studies a couple years ago by both UBS and Credit Suisse of listed family companies. I think on one hand, it showed that family companies tend not to engage in as much M&A, which they would say, actually, they said is tends to be more destructive of value. I think on the R&D, I'm trying to recall how they came out. I think family businesses did okay on it, but of course, they're listed. I think, you know, I can speak to our case, and I heard a recent, when I was at a Pacific Pension meeting 2 weeks ago, I heard a speech by Frank Mars, the chairman of, or, you know, senior family member at the Mars Candy Company, which is one of the largest family companies in the world. So our company, I think we don't have a formal budget, but our chairman is a very innovative person. We came out with the first coal transshipment loader in Indonesia 15 years ago. He likes to sort of redesign the ships to try to maximize efficiency. Now, having said that, to be very transformational, that's a big change for us because our core business is shipping. He does some tech investing and all that through his own family office arm. But for our own core business, yeah, I mean, we're shipping coal. We're very exposed to the oil and gas industry out of Thailand. How do we change? It's honestly, we don't have a fixed budget, but it's something we know we need to do. One thing we did think about because we looked at investing in a waste-to-energy company out of Netherlands that does gasification of municipal solid waste. We said, hey, we learned through that there was a World Bank study, the waste, municipal solid waste per person is going to like double in the next 15 years. It's crazy. Of course, plastics being one of the main parts of it too. And so it's, well, you know, actually, the logistics and shipping of waste is going to be an issue. So can we get into that business somehow? So that's something we're starting to think about. I think in general, family companies can be very committed to R&D, particularly when a family member takes it up as a cause. So in the case of Frank Mars, he was talking about some of their initiatives in agricultural-related investing. Of course, he's probably looking down his supply chain to supply almonds and cocoa and whatever for his candy bars and all that. But so he mentioned that, you know, he's one of the companies that they're nurturing. They've invested a substantial amount of money. I think it was over $100 million in some sort of algae-based company. Mm-hmm. So when there were a couple of other institutional PE funds that focus on agriculture investing. So I asked them, hey, you just heard Mr. Mars say that. What do you think about it? They go, well, it's not something their fund could do, but it takes a wealthy family to be able to take that kind of bet.
How amazing. So listen, talking about waste, I know that right now there are discussions, interestingly enough, obviously, given the scale of Asia Pacific and ASEAN and China in particular, there are all these locally and global franchise food and beverage businesses. And believe it or not, there are businesses that are looking to buy back all the used cooking oil and bring it back to continental Europe for added value and, you know, to the States. So the waste is to the eyes of the beholder, and it's one of the most promising frontiers.
Yeah, so they say someone else's junk is someone else's jewel or something like that. But, you know, I think, you know, you look at India's banning single-use plastics, I think, pretty soon or something, a single-use something or another pretty soon.
Plastic.
So it's an issue. You know, it's a huge issue. And I think countries like Thailand and Indonesia, the plastics and the amount of plastics they generate for the oceans is very large.
Yulin, you're sitting in Asia Pacific. Lately, there have been some rumblings in Hong Kong, and the world is watching. My view is that the world should really work towards a prosperous, successful, and functioning Asia Pacific at large. That includes ASEAN, that includes China, and the rest of, you know, Korean Peninsula. Do you feel that sometimes there's a sense of naivety from, continental Europe or the States when they look at developments in Asia-Pacific, thinking that they know it better than, you know, the local population there? And my point is that, complexities in Asia-Pacific will have tremors and effects across the globe. And I think sometimes being separated by both Pacific Ocean and, you know, Indian Ocean and Atlantic Ocean, sometimes the grasp of the West or the Western world as such is not as in-depth in understanding the intricacies and the history. What is your take? What are your concerns about what's happening at the moment in Hong Kong as a business, as a family business, and at large, the continuous stability of Asia Pacific?
Wow. Okay. So, we shifted our headquarters from Hong Kong to Singapore back, I think, in 91. It was before my time, before I joined IMC. I think Singapore as a whole feels it's going to benefit with a lot. I think people will divert to Singapore rather than Hong Kong. You know, I think Hong Kong, or maybe let me take a step back. You know, my mom left Hong Kong age 20. She's been in the States for 72 years. She was a U.S. ambassador under Clinton to the Asian Development Bank. So she's very American. However, when it touches on some of these issues, she, you know, including at Pacific Pension meetings, reminds people about history. So I think something that Westerners do not remember very well or don't know at all is history. So, you know, China thinks of, you know, hundreds of years at a time, while the U.S. history itself, and I'm born in America, is only, 250 years old. So, you know, for example, the current treaty negotiation, the trade tariffs and all that, I think it probably brings up memories within China about the unequal treaties imposed in China and, you know, during the Opium Wars in the 1840s. Or, you know, when I visited the Summer Palace, it's pretty, there was somewhere they say, hey, the British and the French burned down the Summer Palace in 1865. If I talk to British or French people, I don't think they know that. Correct. Or a few years ago, I took a friend of mine from college, and we were in Beijing. We took a leisurely one day through the Forbidden City, and there were pictures of U.S. Marines camped out in Forbidden City because after the Boxer Rebellion of 1899 and the eight legations, you know, a lot of the troops came into Beijing, including U.S. troops. So, you know, how would the U.S. feel if China had Marines camped out on the White House lawn? So, you know, I think Westerners don't really appreciate maybe that, hey, Asians remember the colonial era. My grandfather worked for a British company, I think ICI. But, you know, there's kind of that resentment. They were kind of treated like second-class citizens. They did benefit from living in, I think it was the International or French Concession of Shanghai, but you are treated as a second-class citizen or regarded as such. And so I think there's lack of understanding of history and the feelings of people, and, you know, is it really the Western system is the best? I mean, I personally think it is. I'm from America, but there are a lot of things to say that, you know, there are other systems that work too.
Well, you were talking about, some of the best performing companies and visionaries, and you, in the early part of our conversation, talked about your days at, the Acer and how perhaps Stan Shih's hybrid model was rather very helpful. So I think both have a lot to share with one another and a lot to learn from one another. And this high horses of morality and we know it all is sometimes rings hollow in, you know, in more ancient parts of the globe, as you rightly said. Now, moving forward, how would you like to look back? We're talking about history. What do you like to do at IMC? What are your biggest ambitions? Where do you like to see IMC if you and I are having this podcast and conversation in 20 years from now? What should IMC, from your lens, look like? What is your, perhaps, legacy? What do you like to do? And I'm keen to understand where do you want to take it from here?
So, you know, I'm 57, so my runway is not that long, I don't think. I think what I've done in my time at IMC, I set up the legal department, a really true international professionalized legal department. I've been helpful in working with Western companies. I think, though, our strategy may be turning more toward within intra-Asia, like Indonesia, and like you said, the One Belt, One Road initiative. So I think, you know, that's probably the right thing for us to do. I think my cousin, you know, I think when I got more involved in Family Business Network, I realized, you know, he's got a whole separate set of issues because he's the owner. He's got the legacy to carry on. He's got a lot of pressure. It's his money at stake. You know, at the end of the day, I'm an employee, so I don't have that same pressure. I can understand his pressure, but it's different. So, you know, I think for me, it's not looking as long-term as him. It's kind of like, okay, I've got some day-to-day issues to deal with. I am on dealing with four joint ventures that we've had for anywhere from 13 to 19 years. So family business is long-term, but when you have long-term JVs like that, your partners change, their financial condition change. If you're dealing with the multinational, they rotated their people. So for me, it's kind of more tactical day-to-day to try to, you know, resolve some of these joint venture issues that we have. I think in terms of new businesses, it's probably better for maybe some of that we bring in some younger people. So I think that's what I would like to do to help recruit and transition to the next team of management. Honestly, we've not been that successful. We keep on bringing in people, but we've not been able to retain them. Mm-hmm. I think when they come in from multinationals, often they realize, you know, they fit better in multinationals.
Mm-hmm. That's part of our conversation early on that, you know, I asked, how did they keep you when you came back from Silicon Valley?
Well, you know, yeah. So, you know, I married my wife. Otherwise, I would have been out of here. Acer kept on asking me whether I would go back. And, you know, I think in the sense that that is a very high bar that Stan Shi set. So I had the privilege of working for Stan Shi. He worked me hard. And, you know, it took me 8 months. And I remember I flew to Taipei to tell Stan I was leaving. My uncle even made a trip to Taipei to say he would like his nephew to join him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Stan was very unusual in the sense that even though at the time I left, it was a $5.7 billion company, he knew people by their first name. He knew people at all levels. And I think what I learned a lot from him as a manager is humility. Mm-hmm. And the ability to listen. So I told Stan, I see him maybe once every year or so when I go to Taiwan, and I'll have a lunch and dinner with him and his wife. And I said, Stan, I cannot imagine how much headache I gave you, because Stan would typically have employees line up. When he'd go to the States, you get to pick him up at the airport, drop him off at the airport, or you get a 1 hour slot on the weekend. And we're all there downloading about the internal politics, you know, et cetera. And I said, Stan, I just cannot imagine how you could listen to all of us complaining about each other and not explode. He goes, I have a very big head. So I look back, I said, Stan, I wish I'd learned more, but I look back at what you did and how you lead and your humbleness. And, you know, I think Stan's a very example of a great leader.
But Yolen, I think a big head has to go with a big heart as well. You know, there's no
shortage. Yeah, I'm sure
that must have been the other element. You talked very humbly about yourself that, you know, I'm an employee and all of that, and I always remind my guests, friends, business associates, and people as gifted as your good self, that even a Rolex watch would not function without that little piece within the movement or an IWC. So I don't think that it's about the size, it's about the impact, it's about the contribution. And it's about how one, perhaps even in my opinion, exudes and contaminates in a good way the organization with all of its learning. So I guess everything that you have gathered all these years is of great importance to IMC. I am happy that you joined us, and thank you for being on RoundPeg Podcast. I am sure this conversation is to be continued. And on a closing remark, just to let you know, they say these days, the young old, the old old. These are the new terms. So 57, okay. So 57 hasn't even arrived to young old, let alone being old. So I'm sure you're there for many years. And thank you for being on the podcast. And I'm sure we will have this conversation continue. I'd like to thank my guest, Yulin Yang, and thank you all for listening. I hope you can join us on our next podcast, where I will be joined by Helen Antonia Molson, the executive coach and the author of Back to Hockey and Beer. capturing the story of Erik Molson, the legendary entrepreneur and family member of the Molson dynasty. You've been listening to Round Peg Podcast, brought to you by Business Families Foundation and 360 Strategic Advisors. We hope you really liked what you heard today. You can always subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or other platforms to hear the next conversation and our new episodes as soon as they become available.